everyone. Welcome back to Things We Read This Week. I'm Jordan Nanos, joined again by Hunter Almgren, and we are back. We got a big show. We're going to talk about vibe coding, about MCP, about AI taking jobs, and about DeepSeek. So picking up right where we left off, just, I think, 3 months of progress on all the same topics.
Yeah, 3 months of progress and 3 months of, I don't know.
Sunshine, spring has sprung.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say,
I was going to say 3 months of AI companies getting exposed to scams and going bankrupt.
I guess the glass is half empty for you. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, it's just funny. It's just funny because, you know, the whole builder AI story, like, that I've been following and like what's actually happened with that. That's like, it's like real human beings trying to mimic LLM responses in their responses to end user prompts. And it's like
API driven, man. It's API driven.
I couldn't believe it. Like, wait,
for those in the audience, API stands for a person in India for some of these companies.
Exactly. And it's just funny to me because like this whole time, everybody in like the creative community is trying to not be like AI and not have their work flagged as AI generated. And then on the other side of it, you have people running entire companies of people who are trying to mimic AI because they don't have the money to actually build the AI systems that they're promising to deliver. It's hilarious.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny. I mean, I just see this looking at LinkedIn or Twitter or even people's blog posts on Medium or emails that you get, whatever. The flag for me of people using AI with the dash, the long dash to break things up instead of parentheses or a new line character or something like that, or a comma, is just, it's such a tell that somebody is using AI, specifically ChatGPT seems to, that dash seems to be its favorite.
Seems to be guilty of that a lot.
Yeah, but I think a lot of people are, you know, this is, I mean, I don't know if I would call blog posts an art, but with a lot of art, you end up being a curator with good taste or a director trying to compose something with the AI kind of doing the work for you. And it creates a lot of, just a lot more content, some slop, some good stuff. I'm personally kind of cognizant of like losing my ability to write English or code the more that I vibe it out.
The more that you rely on these tools.
Yeah, but like I, you know, went on a trip, like a holiday vacation, and the amount that I was able to like compose stuff together by just asking questions and kind of learn about the history of places or like local cuisine or language or things like that in real time with an assistant that's an expert in that relative to me was pretty awesome. And like, maybe, okay, I learned, you know, you lose something because you're not talking to a local, but it's better than nothing at all, certainly for me.
Well, and I think that's like a statement too about even like the use of like augmented reality. Like, you know, when I was in Spain, one of the people in our group had the Meta Ray-Bans.
Yeah.
And was like telling me about like, oh yeah, like I can just like look at this sign that's written in Spanish and it translates it for me. I'm like, that's cool, right? Because, you know, if you're somewhere, you have no idea where you are and everything's in a language that you don't speak, like the ability to just like look at something and go, okay, yeah, I understand what that is telling me or like where I am, right? Like that's really cool. Or like look at menus and have them translated for you.
Yeah, with the glasses, I didn't even consider that. I was using my phone in Japan, and it's like such a, it really helps with vending machines and stuff. But sometimes it doesn't help. Like, you'll translate it and I'll be looking at them, I'll be going, Muscat grape, like, okay, now I gotta Google what that is.
Yeah, like it tells you the English.
I can see it's a grape from the picture. What exactly is a muscat grape, guys? Yeah. Anyway, let's get into it. So, yeah, speaking of vibing it out, I don't know, where do you want to start with some comments from powerful AI people, I guess?
Yeah, so it's there was an interesting interview with the CEO of Anthropic where he basically said AI could wipe out half of all entry-level white-collar jobs and spike unemployment to 10 to 20% in the next 1 to 5 years. He's basically saying that there's going to be some sort of like job apocalypse that happens where the role of a junior developer or a junior salesperson or a junior accountant or whatever, like, just ceases to exist. And it kind of goes along the lines of like what Mark Zuckerberg said at the Meta Llama conference about how they're going to replace a bunch of their junior developers with AI coders that can basically just, you know, work a full 8-hour day, just plugging away, doing commits and whatever. But I think what was really interesting about this interview was that, you know, Dario's essentially calling for some sort of like token tax, as an example, that can maybe, I don't know, fund some sort of social program for people that are displaced. And, you know, if you look at one of the last like US presidential like campaigns, like, that's something that Andrew Yang talked about a lot, right? Yeah. Is he was talking about like, hey, AI is coming, it's gonna, they took our jobs, like from South Park, like, it's coming, and we need some sort of like UBI strategy to help those displaced. But I don't know, like, part of me wants to think like, okay, that's just like another AI doomer, like, you know, telling us about the end of days. But on the flip side, this is coming from somebody who's enabling the doom that he's talking about, right? So it's like, what? There's two sides of that equation that are very interesting because of who is saying it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can never get past the aspect of like talking your book when I hear about this from the guys that are having, you know, spending their day meeting with the researchers that work for them and getting the latest updates. So surely they know more about this than me on the technical side, but then going and meeting with the press and then going and meeting with investors. And you have to imagine that there's a through line there where something that he sees when he talks to the researchers, he shares with the press in the context of, oh my gosh, there's going to be unemployment, this is going to be impactful, watch out for the wave that's coming, if it's not already here in some pretty measurable ways, I would say. And then go talk to investors and say, look how valuable we are when we're one of the five places in the world that's going to be benefiting from the automation of all of these jobs and all of the people using it. So I think there's an aspect of it, talking his book. I also think the error bars are kind of interesting. Like, typically it's up to half of these, you know, jobs are going away. So you got big error bars there. And then you've got in the next 1 to 5 years, that's a huge amount of time. There's an entire presidential term in there in the US, right? And then there's like, I think he also says 10 to 20%. Of all jobs or all white collar jobs or something like that. So if you look at the bottom of it, on in one respect, the forecasts seem ridiculous. Like, let's say you have automation of exactly half of all entry level jobs in the next year. That seems like a crazy estimate to me, right?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, if you have 10% change in all entry-level white-collar jobs, or just all white collar jobs in total over the next 5 years. That seems like very reasonable to me and pretty comparable to other transformations like COVID and work from home, or like the internet bubble and, you know, boom and bust, where if you think about it, the internet was an incredibly transformative technology. It lets people build companies all around the world. You can employ people in different countries. You can do all of these different things that you couldn't do before, sell stuff online, contact people quickly, real-time updates to product availability, marketing, like there's all sorts of changes. And, you know, the economy was kind of resilient. There wasn't an entire massive social change, but there, on the span of 20 years, there's gradually been a big change that Andrew Yang pointed out, where manufacturing, like Detroit was the biggest city in the US for a while, and now there's not a lot of people with jobs there, especially in the internet. So I don't know if you can look at all the political and economic implications that I can like really hypothesize about where that's actually going to go. I think the more interesting thing is to look at the technology. Dario's got access to stuff that we don't, sees next generation models, next generation model experiences, feedback from people who are using Claude for code. And I think he's clearly talking about a radically better product coming soon.
Well, and even like, I would say like, how much more radically better can it get when even the current, what is it, Opus 4 model can basically sit there and code by itself for 7 hours straight without any human intervention? How much more do we need to get? I mean, are we shooting for like 24-hour coding cycles where you just have these agents churning out code while everyone else is sleeping? And then when everybody wakes up in the morning, they review what that agent wrote?
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's partially, it's the like curation thing I was just talking about earlier that you know, I've been doing in my daily life, which is, you see the same thing here. And I can talk about it in terms of how I develop applications. Like it's, there's always a like back and forth that happens between the, you know, user community or the product team who wants to define some features that they want to see in the application. And then the actual agent that's going to go code, the software engineer, the developer is going to go implement it. The implementation is like, is pretty like really good right now. If you can steer it and say, yeah, that feature's good, that feature's bad or whatever. What's kind of missing or has been missing is the language model with the vision to kind of look at an application, work through it with computer control and like give feedback. Yeah. But the middle piece of translating a feature that the person wants to see into a long product requirements document that then gets fed into an agent that's going to go develop the code, like that exists right now and it's really good. So,
I think based on what I've seen too, like just in my own experience, another thing that's missing is like UI UX, like the current models don't seem to be very good at that because they don't understand design aesthetic very well. And so like a lot of like the React.js interfaces that I've generated on my own just to see what the capabilities are, even giving it guidelines of like, hey, make it look like this or that. At the end of the day, what gets spit out is it looks like an engineer designed a UI. Right. Yeah. It's not pretty. It's very basic. It like is functional only. And so I don't know that we're, I mean, maybe we will, but like, I don't know that we're going to get to the point of like Apple level UI design anytime soon with something that's generated from an LLM.
Yeah. I mean, I've got my doubts. I think it's really dependent on the model. Like the models that have vision, in my experience, you know, they're big and they're expensive, but like you can take a screenshot of a UI and it will replicate it pretty closely.
Yeah.
And if you're saying, oh, you know, this like, oh, the thing that stands in the way of the model being able to automate away an entire entry-level software engineer's job is some aesthetic aspects of the UI, like, well, that kind of settles the argument. Like, that person's not getting hired, in my view. I mean, sorry.
Yeah, what's interesting about it too is that, you know, I was reading this on TechCrunch, you know, a few days ago that,
well, yeah, it's already happening.
Yeah, they're this VC firm Signal Fire is basically saying that at least in the startup communities, it's already happening, right? So like they're, and we, you know, you've seen news articles about like, you know, what was it, Klarna replacing half of their engineers already, and like there are other people doing this, I think, in the startup space. I don't know that the larger the company, it seems like the less it's happening at this point in time, because they're typically taking a more cautious or conservative approach to doing that. I mean, I'm not saying it's not happening, but I'm just saying it's happening a lot less.
Yeah.
The larger and more quote unquote legacy of a company you go, right? I mean, if you're a startup like a Klarna or like Codium, you know, is another good example of like, yeah, I can create an entire company with a $500 LLC and a couple LLMs, and I can go pitch that to people by hiring like basically one guy for marketing, one guy for, you know, handful of people for engineering to oversee product development. You know, I can basically keep the circle small. My max company size is maybe 20 people, but I can generate millions of dollars in revenue very easily, right? Yeah. So you do see that a lot in the startup space. But for somebody like a, you know, a Microsoft or like a Meta is a great example. Like that's a pretty bold claim to me, right? Meta being as large of a company as they are, saying that like, we're just going to cut the bottom half of our development staff in the next couple of years and replace it with AI. Like that's pretty bold.
Yeah. I mean, so it's interesting because I don't know if they're saying exactly that. A lot of the big companies are saying they're going to stop hiring or shrink hiring, or they're going to let, you know, people who leave, they're not going to backfill them. And fair enough, right? They're the biggest companies in the world. They are, you know, the consultants and their executives probably all say, let's pursue efficiency right now. Mm-hmm. And fair enough, that's a strategy you can take through AI. But the one that seems to be winning to me to create a whole bunch of enterprise value is pursuing higher quality in products and services that you're providing, which inherently means growing, like getting bigger, doing more, doing better work, winning versus the competition, that sort of stuff. And I even though it seems possible on the face of it, I think the cultural difference of, you know, cutting and shrinking and being efficient really flies in the face of growing and improving quality and doing more. So startups, I mean, it just seems like that's the thing to pursue right now. Just go bigger, do more, higher quality, and and you'll be rewarded thanks to the tools of AI. You know, like, yeah, okay, maybe a single person can create a multi-million dollar company that, you know, couldn't have in the past because AI is just making them so much more productive. But, you know, the multi-billion dollar companies like Codium that sold to OpenAI, for example, like a couple of years after if it was founded, it's not a single person because they're just moving faster, doing higher quality work and growing. So, yeah, interesting stuff, man.
Yeah, I think that's actually a good segue. Speaking of coding, a good segue into I was cracking up at this headline: vibe coding, shipping features or shipping vulnerabilities?
Yeah, this is funny, man. So
it is.
I'm possibly seeing the ChatGPT dash in that blog. I think the for the boomers, what is vibe coding? Like, I'm seeing a prompt of be a little bit controversial coming in here, but I don't know. I totally, like, you know, agree with the whatever the concept in this shipping features or shipping vulnerabilities, like, yeah, blind trust in AI suggestions. This is like, this is actively happening in my life without thinking about it right now.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, and there have been some examples that I've seen on X and other places of, you know, hey, like, I used Anthropic's latest model to refactor an application that I wrote 10 years ago, and it actually did a really good job and made a lot of really good suggestions and optimizations, but it also wrote 9 known CVE exploits, like Sev9 plus, into my code that wasn't there before. So
yeah, so I'm with you here. I do think it's a problem. I think this is a little bit of you know, sour grapes from people who are getting their job automated away, like in live time, by younger people who shouldn't know much about this. Kind of the, you know, the rock band drummer who's saying, like, oh, that's not real music because you're using a electronic, like, drum machine pad or something like that.
Yeah.
But so it's a total problem. But to me, I mean, the back and forth of having a model inspect your code, identify security exploits, explain ways in which this could be an issue, write tests, you know, do all of this stuff. To me, like, it's an attitude or a prioritization issue with the developer, more so than it is a problem with using the models. Like, somebody who's lazy and programming is going to have security exploits, whether they're using a model or not. And somebody who's lazy and doesn't consider security when they're using a model, maybe they create a lot more security exploits, more obvious, you know, a lot faster. But the result is going to be the same, which is that, hey, you have an issue. I would hope people vibe coding would use the model still to consider security as part of their development process.
And so are you talking about vibing DevSecOps now? Like, is that the next evolution of vibe coding? Like,
yeah, VibeSec, man.
VibeSec, yeah. Dude, I can imagine if any security, like, people are listening to this, just literally sweating and having a heart attack over the concept of vibing, you know, code security. But I think, I guess where my head's at is, like, Spectre, Meltdown, like those, like, memory vulnerabilities, like, really exposed, like, a lack of people doing, like, writing memory protection into code, right? So, like, you know, C, for example, like, it's very good at writing protected memory spaces for routines, but you have to know how to do it. Yeah. And it's not easy, right? And as you go further up the stack to higher level languages like Objective-C, like Python, like Rust, it gets even harder, right?
Rust easier, but yeah, I get what you're saying.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, the higher up you go, the harder it is to write those protections into the code because you're so abstracted from the, you know, the underlying operating system functions or, you know, CPU functions or whatever. And I'm not saying that every application needs that, but, like, I do agree with you that anybody who is, like, doing vibe coding, I guess, like, should really be thinking about security, because otherwise, like, I might just pivot and become a black hat and just start, you know, stealing crypto from everybody with the way that vibe coding is going. Like, like, why not?
Come on, why, man, not? We got transcripts going on here. You're gonna make me cut this part of the episode out?
No. It's a joke meant to illustrate that, like,
yeah.
As a cyber criminal, my job is potentially getting easier with, like, the
as a theoretical cyber criminal for those listening, not a
but like
explicit about this.
Yes, as a theoretical cyber criminal, my job is getting infinitely easier because, like, I don't know, like, when was the last time you've heard of anybody getting exploited with a SQL injection? Like, I'm pretty sure everybody closed that gap many years ago, but are we reopening it by not taking a lens on cybersecurity as we're using LLMs to generate and optimize code?
Yeah, so so this, yes, the landscape of security vulnerabilities is absolutely massive, growing over time as people get lazier and use these tools. Let's provide an example. MCP, so Model Context Protocol, originally developed by Anthropic, adopted by all the other major labs. Take your existing application, and instead of having a generic REST API, have a protocol that the language model is, you know, more easily able to use and adopt for agent-based workflows. What does this mean? Well, specifically, let's look at GitHub. The official MCP server for GitHub, GitHub has an API, but it also now has an MCP server, is going to grant an LLM a whole host of new abilities, like being able to read and create issues in repositories that the user has access to, and then submit new PRs. So like the LLM can work on your behalf inside a GitHub repo. Mm-hmm. However, Simon Willison, awesome guy, he describes this as a lethal trifecta for prompt injection. It can access private data. It has exposure to malicious instructions like delete your repo, like delete a branch.
Sudo rm-rf.
And the ability to remove the French package and the ability to exfiltrate information. So, you know, what does this mean? Well, like, yeah, exactly as you're saying, opening up applications like GitHub, like your OneDrive, like your, you know, Google, like your G Suite of applications, like Salesforce, like everything that, you know, what's that company? Zapier has access to, these like automated workflow sort of things. I mean, this is a, it's just a massive amount of exposure that you're adopting if you're wanting to simplify things by using an LLM. So exactly like what we're saying, except now it's not just your, well, it is your private repo for your private applications, kind of exactly what we're saying right now. You're the single person with a vibe coding. And if you're deciding to use the MCP server instead of just like have the LLM punch into your VS Code, and then you as the user run git commit, git push,
yeah,
if the model's doing that for you, now all of a sudden this thing can take actions that you're not approving, the human's not in the loop. You're open to a whole bunch of new exploits.
Yeah. I think though, on a positive note, regarding MCP just in general, like, I really feel that MCP is AI's REST API moment.
Yeah.
Like, where all of the sudden now we have a common framework for disparate things to talk to each other, and we're not having to like write custom integrations every single time we need something to function. Like, I remember, you know, being a data center administrator 15 years ago, pre-REST API, and like, okay, like, I want to build a private cloud. Okay, well, I have HPE servers, and I have NetApp storage, and I have Cisco switches, and none of them talk to each other. Great. Yeah. How is my automation going to work, right? How do I enable self-service catalogs? How do I do all that? And like back then, yeah, like it sucked. That's why, you know, you had so many people basically fail at building a private cloud. But then the Redfish Consortium came along with this whole concept of REST APIs. And over time, more and more data center vendors like built REST APIs into their product. It's a common data model. It's a common access model, so that like if I can write one Terraform build plan or one Ansible playbook, and it can execute across all three disparate stacks. that's awesome. I feel like MCP is going to get there, but one of the big things for me that's missing. So like the REST API has a data model security, like a data security model built into it, right? Like built into the implementation spec. I think that for these types of vulnerabilities to go away, MCP as a protocol needs to also have that sort of like data security model embedded into the implementation so that like, okay, now I can actually trust this, take these actions and know that I'm not exposing myself to some sort of like prompt injection attack or like, you know, some sort of like malicious, like man in the middle attack on the MCP server where I'm like intercepting the communication between two LLM agents.
Yeah. So it's interesting, man. I think the protocol does a good job of doing this at this point. Mm-hmm. The problem is that continues to happen with all LLMs is prompt injection. So, it's not the thing with a REST API is it's deterministic. You run a command, you know, what's executing with an LLM, you send in a prompt. You actually have no deterministic way of knowing what that model is going to do because every time the prompt's different, right? It's got some different context in it. It's got some different, instructions, like it's got something specific to the user. Otherwise we're just making an API call. Right. And so, you know, the idea of like an application calling an API, like, you know, the Windsurf editor from Codeium calling the GitHub API when a user clicks somewhere or, you know, when some conditional happens, makes sense. But the thing that's different is the model is making the decision in some chain of thought to actually use that tool. And so like Simon has a good way of describing it here. He was concerned about the three ingredients all being present in a workflow. So like one MCP server would let you have access to private data. A second MCP server would have exposure to malicious instructions inside that server, that changed the behavior of the model when it gets it back. The third one has the ability to exfiltrate information and like, you know, the model provides some information to it and suddenly the attacker is able to get it out of there. He summarizes it saying, well, it's not actually three different MCP servers. It's all present in GitHub because it's got your private code you don't want people to see. It's got the ability for somebody to inject some malicious instructions.
Malicious code. And then
it's got the ability for the user who gets a commit uploaded to their side to exfiltrate information. It's crazy. So, and I think the big thing about this is that like the cat and mouse game, we're going to need some really smart security researchers to figure this out because I have no idea how you put the guardrails around an LLM to have it be identifying malicious instructions inside of other Git repos. Like when a new company releases a new model, like, you know, we'll talk about DeepSeek's new release here, or Anthropic came out with Claude and Opus and Sonnet 4 or O3 or something. It's like a matter of 4 hours before people are posting the system prompt online because they've got the right prompt injection attack that can get it out, right? And you just keep rolling. Like, there's, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's kind of like one of those things in the data center business where if a malicious actor has physical access to your hardware, can it compromised sort of thing, right? Like we've just never been able to make a hardware system that's completely resilient to somebody who has physical access and can do stuff to it, plug something in.
Right.
And to me, if an LLM has access to it, it's a something as part of an agent workflow, I'd consider it compromised. Like you have to be comfortable with that private data being exposed.
And if you're not, you don't use it, right? Or at least until like, you know, your comment about the security researcher thing is interesting because I'm actually closely watching that space. And I've like had a couple conversations with like CrowdStrike around like the direction that they're moving into like model security and stuff like that. And it's like, to me, it's a super interesting space to watch because I don't know how much like conventional security ways of thinking you can really apply to this. Like, it's almost like we need like a novel security concept that is specific to AI that doesn't apply conventional wisdom in the security space, right? Like, we, that's what I'm really watching right now, is like, how do all of these like very prominent security companies that have like entire divisions of research labs that employ extremely smart people that like all day they're trying to find either new vulnerabilities or new ways of securing things, like how are they looking at this? That's kind of what I'm watching.
Yeah, everything I've seen so far seems to say that because it's not deterministic, and because it's AI or an LLM, and there's not a human in the loop, the only way to kind of identify these issues is with AI, is with classification models, is with other LLMs, because how do I figure out if a malicious prompt is, if I'm seeing a malicious prompt? Probably need a model to review it, because there's really no way to write deterministic code and say, hash the stuff in there, and if it matches, you know, known prompt injection attack, like, do that. Or, you know, some fine-tuning, you know, workflow at the end of training where you're gonna fine-tune the model to reject certain prompt injection attacks. So like this cat and mouse game is just never going to be able to catch up with all of these attacks.
The other question that I just thought of too is like, just thinking about this, there are certain aspects of this that I feel could be potentially easy to prevent. Like, MCP server A communicating with MCP server B that's malicious. Well, an easy way to stop that would be to just use something like X509 certificates, where MCP server A has to verify with MCP server B that it's a trusted resource. If the handshake is there, proceed. If it's not, task failed. Yeah, right? Like, there's certain aspects of this I feel like we already have the technology today to fix. The prompt injection stuff, yeah, I'm right there with you. Like, I don't think that we have a great answer for that right now.
Yeah, yeah. So, here we go. Let me just share something I was remembering. I can't find the exact announcement on Anthropic's website, but they had a six-level classifier program where they offered a bounty if you were able to find a universal jailbreak on their system. And I think it was about a day in, and most people got stopped after about the third level. But what do you find down here? Live demo results, key findings. Yeah, here we go.
Oh, okay.
Number of users who passed the challenge at each level. Mm-hmm. So 339 users were able to pass Q1. There's four users who are able to pass all of the eight levels of classifiers that they were using in order to protect against prompt injection attacks. And so therefore they awarded a $20,000 cash prize to the first person to pass all eight levels. And they paid a total of $55,000 out there to Altınbek Ismailov, somebody named Hunter. So yeah, I mean, like, I think this was live for like 5 days.
Okay.
You know, this is the probably the premier, certainly one of the premier model companies, and the premier company in terms of at least talking about AI safety. Mm-hmm. They certainly have the most people working on it, and they certainly have the most public products that seem to announced they're serious about it with constitutional AI and everything. And like 5 days in, four people publicly announced that they've gotten through the biggest, you know, eight levels of moats and drawbridges and portcullis and whatever you can keep people out with. So, anyway, it's pretty revealing. So, yeah. Anyway, wrap up by talking about DeepSeek. Teased that a bit earlier.
Yeah, man. DeepSeek's always a good topic.
So, update from these guys. This one certainly is a little less world-changing and ground-shaking than the one from January and December, V3 and R1. What they did with this release is update R1.
With new weights.
Yeah, new weights, same architecture, and new benchmark results. So you can see here on screen the benchmark results as we compare R1 May 28th to R1, you know, with the blue and the white stripes here for those watching, and then R1 with the light blue at the very right side. Significant improvements across all of these benches. Live Code Bench and Aider are the ones that I view most closely because they most closely relate to my like coding development workflow.
Live Code development workflow.
Yeah, edit stuff in in there. But the other ones, I mean, huge improvements across the board. And I just want to point out something that I think I commented on this in December when they released V3. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I think people have gotten enough, like DeepSeek has gotten enough recognition about the aspects of reinforcement learning that improve the model's, you know, performance so significantly with so little compute, and just the amount of improvement that the thinking tokens, like the reasoning, can have on this stuff. But the thing that still shocks me is that this is the biggest model released by a factor of 3. And both DeepSeek and Qwen are Chinese models. So the biggest, you know, other model that's out there is Llama 4 Maverick or Llama 3.1 405B, which is, I guess DeepSeek is 50% bigger, but it's an MOE. So anyway, the point is that this is by far, far the biggest model that's open source.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can kind of see the benefits of having that many parameters over time when you just let the training run, keep ripping and add more data. And they've got some sort of a flywheel in here where the more data that they get from users, the more labels that they can generate, the more synthetic data that they can generate, the better this gets. The last thing that I'll leave you with, this is a bit of speculation, but somebody on X says, if you're wondering why the new DeepSeek R1 sounds a bit different, I think they probably switched from training on synthetic OpenAI to synthetic Gemini outputs. You can see kind of in the classifications that they use here.
Yeah.
They're very different, and it's very close to Gemini models in terms of the creative writing, quote unquote, slot profile that this guy is using to identify.
Slop profile. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's an interesting rank, but basically, like it identifies the top tokens or words or bigrams, like multiple words that the model's using, and you know, it's an easy way to identify similarity or like semantic similarity between this model's output coming to others. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Gemini passing OpenAI on the LM Arena leaderboard could lead to more people using the API, including other labs, to generate synthetic data for the RL creative writing capabilities here, which is not covered in a lot of detail in their papers. So
yeah.
Interesting stuff.
Very interesting. Well, I think that's about at time, sir. It's good to be back, man. We'll have to get back to the weekly cadence, or at least bi-weekly.
Every week, if we feel like it.
Every week, if we feel like it, or we're not on a plane somewhere. although, I will say, and I think I had mentioned this a while back, but like with, you know, I'm a big United Airlines guy. With United getting Starlink by the end of this year into next year, who knows? We might be doing, I might be doing episodes from, you know, seat 10C and Economy Plus. We don't know.
We'll need some good noise canceling headphones on there, buddy. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. All right. Take care, everyone. Bye.